Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the second terrorist attack in Europe, where a big rig truck was used as a weapon of mass destruction, this time plowing into shoppers at a Christmas market in Berlin. Thomas Berger, Professor of International Relations at Boston University, who specializes in German politics, joins us to discuss how already the leader of the far-right Alternative for Germany party has labeled the victims of an attack that the Islamic State is taking credit for, Merkel's dead, indicating how explosive a political issue it will be if the perpetrator turns out to be a refugee from the Middle East. We will also examine how right-wing parties across Europe are stoking anti-immigrant xenophobia, which plays into the hands of the Islamic State, who want to drive a wedge between refugees and Muslims in Europe and the populations of the host countries. Then we'll look into why Trump's new national security advisor, General Michael Flynn, met recently with the head of Austria's anti-immigrant Freedom Party, which was founded by former Nazis. Daniel Serwer, professor and director of the Conflict Management Program and senior fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, joins us to discuss the capture of U.S. national security and strategy by conspiracy theorists, ethnic nationalists, and anti-Semites, who are the top close advisors of a president-elect who is an anti-immigration bigot who ran on a platform of ethnic cleansing of Mexicans and Muslim immigrants. Then finally, we'll examine the announcement today in Moscow by the foreign ministers of Russia, Turkey, and Iran that they are ready to act as guarantors in a peace deal between the Syrian government and the opposition. Ori Barkey, the director of the Middle East program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, joins us to discuss the growing anti-American and pro-Russian rhetoric coming from Erdogan's government that prompted Secretary of State Kerry to raise concerns about allegations of American involvement in the assassination of the Russian ambassador, which Erdogan blames on Fethullah Gulen, the exiled cleric living in the United States. And joining us now is Thomas Berger, who's a professor of international relations at Boston University, who specializes in German politics, international relations, comparative government, and political culture. He's the author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II and Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Berger.
Good to talk to you, as always.
And it does seem that the atrocity that took place in Berlin yesterday is going to create quite a political crisis. The million almost so refugees that Germany took in, that sort of Angela Merkel took a very strong and moral stand on against a lot of criticism. And if it becomes clear that if they find this person that perpetrated this, and they had to let go the guy that they arrested, this Pakistani fellow, if it turns out that this person is a refugee seeking asylum, won't that be a nightmare for Angela Merkel and her party? She's already in trouble, isn't she?
Absolutely. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. Angela Merkel took a very strong, principled stance on the refugee issue last summer. And it was one which was controversial, but also one which won her considerable applause, both domestically and abroad. Problems with integrating and dealing with the refugees has been increasingly clear. And one should also understand that this is against the backdrop of Germany, which has been becoming increasingly globalized and internationalized. Germany used to see itself as being Germany, the country of Germans, a country defined by a community of descent, of ethnic and of ethnic ties of one people. And over the last two decades or so, Germany has been coming to terms with the fact that it's no longer that society. It's a country of a very diverse and increasingly diverse populations, with people from all sorts of backgrounds, from Eastern Europe, from Africa, from the Arab world, and elsewhere. And this has been raising very strong questions about how is it possible to integrate all these different kinds of people, and what are the implications, economic, social, and political, of trying to integrate all these different kinds of people into German society. And Merkel and others, sort of the mainstream German political leadership, have been sort of embracing that task, you know, going about trying to do so. But we also have voices in Germany, and those voices have been getting stronger, especially against the backdrop of this Syrian refugee crisis that began in earnest last summer. In 2015, that is, I should be clear, that say that, you know, Germany has to get reestablish control over its borders, that looking to Europe to work together with other countries in the European region to deal with this issue is not enough, and that Germany, frankly, is really again a country for Germans. And this is the sort of political expression of this is the so-called Alternative for Germany, or Alternative für Deutschland, AfD in German, which has been coming on strong over the last year and a half or so, and which has recently won some important state elections, or it's come in very strongly in some important state elections in Germany. And this, if this in fact turns out to be a refugee or a foreigner, who are resident foreigners, even if they have German citizenship, living in Germany, that is going to make those kinds of voices all the much stronger. And Merkel, who is probably the most successful and popular German politician in the last generation, is going to take another hit, and she's going to be forced, I think, to move further to the right on refugee issues, on immigration issues, and probably on other issues as well.
Well, but you mentioned the AfG, the Alternative for Germany. The leader of its party, Markus Pretzel, he has already said that of the 12 people that were killed in the Berlin market, along with the 49 injured, he has labeled them Merkel's dead.
That's right.
Said that Germany is no longer safe. So he's being shamelessly jumping aboard the bandwagon there in terms of stirring up this xenophobia.
No, there's no doubt about it. That I mean, and the instrument that he used to send out that message, by the way, happened to be a tweet. A tool that we've gotten quite familiar with here in politics in the United States. No, I mean, there's no doubt that for the AfD, this is a big opportunity to drive their message home, to push the argument that the German elites are out of touch with reality, and that German people need to turn to other political leadership in order to get control of the situation. The other force, though, which is also almost as quite important, are people inside of Merkel's own party. Merkel has been, shall we say, centrist, or even left of center within the constellation of the German Democratic, the Christian Democratic Union, her sort of party. But conservative critics inside her own party have been pushing on this issue, partly because they're afraid of the AfD, that is, conservative Germans in particular. I think the sister party of the CDU, the two parties always work together, the CSU, the Christian Socialist Union, which is dominates Bavarian politics in southern Germany, has been very, very critical of Merkel's whole position on immigration. And its leader, a gentleman by the name of Horst Seehofer, also almost immediately after saying that even though he's part of Merkel's government and he's part of the German Conservative Party to which Merkel belongs to, Seehofer almost immediately said that after we have, you know, mourned our losses, we need to rethink our immigration policies. So and Merkel is facing some challenge, some pressure from other political leaders as well, including her finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, a very capable, very much respected political figure in Germany. They're going to push her as well from inside her own party with the argument that unless we get a handle on this issue, we're not going to be able to reassure the German people that they are in fact safe. And then they voters, conservative end of the voting population in Germany will go over to extremists like the AfD. And also what's very important to understand is that the AfD is not only anti-immigrant, they're also anti-Europe. There's this anti-European Union. And they would, in fact, like to go out of the Eurozone, bring back the Deutschmark, and really reverse what has been over two decades or more of German foreign policy. So there are some very, very large stakes.
But again, just as there are ties here between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump that are murky and have yet to be fully fleshed out, the White House, of course, is doing an inquiry into the extent to which Putin tipped the scales in this election to help Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton, who apparently he hates. Putin also, I don't know how much he hates Merkel, but he's, I think he's afraid of Merkel because she speaks his language, he speaks her language. She's got his number pretty clearly, and she's been one of the few people that's tried to talk sense into him in long, long phone conversations. Apparently now she's pretty much given up. Just to show you the kind of nature of Putin, his hatred of, well, I don't know what it's, whether it's hatred, but whenever when he last met with Merkel in Moscow, he learned, being a KGB man, that she had a childhood trauma from being bitten by a dog. So what does Putin do? He brings in his big, huge black dog, and there's pictures of her sitting there in this grand kind of Kremlin drawing room, just, you know, cringing in fear as this big sort of dog looks at her, you know. So we know already that Putin has unleashed the same hackers that he unleashed on the American election or against the Democrats on Germany with these troll farms. And the reason we know it is that the head of German intelligence has told us such.
Right. No, I mean, the whole issue of German relations with Russia is also very interesting. I mean, and you've already gotten a lot of the details here, you know, very nicely explained. I mean, Putin, in many ways, made his early stage career in Germany. He was stationed in Berlin. He speaks apparently fluent German. Merkel grew up in East Germany, and she grew up speaking Russian. So the two of them, I don't know what language they actually use when they meet with each other, perhaps English, but they have a great understanding of each other's language, the culture, and the background out of which they come from. Merkel, that story you told about the dog is a very revealing one. I recall that story, but she also understood that Putin was playing mind games with her, and she didn't allow herself to be intimidated by him. So she's quite strong psychologically, and she, at the same time, whatever personal chemistry, negative in this case, may exist between the two of them, these are two countries that have to come to terms with each other. They are, after all, very large, very powerful countries. They do a lot of trade with each other. And while they no longer have common borders, thank goodness, they have a lot of their spheres of influence overlap in Central and Eastern Europe. So Merkel has to work with Putin and try to stabilize the situation, relations with Russia. And Russia, for its part, is very heavily dependent. I mean, the Russian economy is overwhelmingly dependent upon energy exports and natural exports, needs foreign technology to help modernize its economy. And Germany is one of the major investors in Russia and one of the major partners for modernizing the Russian economy. So Putin, in the long run, also understands that he needs Germany as well. So they're doing a very delicate dance. Now, at the same time, Putin wants to undermine Merkel, and we know that he has been supporting far right-wing populist parties throughout throughout Western Europe, including Marine Le Pen and the Front National in France, and also he seems to be supporting both simultaneously the far right and the far left, the Linke Partei, the left party in Germany, many of them in the eastern part of Germany are ex-communists, and the Alternative for Germany party that you mentioned. And he also seems to be supporting the Pegida, the this is a sort of right-wing anti-immigrant demonstration group, which is pan-European movement against the Islamization of the West, is sort of the direct translation of this. So what we saw to some extent taking place in the United States is taking place in Europe as well, and Putin has some ready allies inside of the German political system. And going back to what we said earlier, one of the focuses of their propaganda is that Islam is a threat to the West, the immigrants are spreading violence and terrorism in Western countries. And in fact, the West should join with Russia in a kind of global battle I dare not use the word crusade, to deal with radical Islam. So this is, again, fits into that narrative, and there's that dimension to the story as well.
Well, you have to add to that list, though, of countries that and parties that Putin has funded and encouraged. If you've got Orban even further to the right than him in Jobbik, it's called, in Hungary. And then you've got in Austria Putin's ties to the anti-immigrant Freedom Party, which is founded after World War II by former Nazis. And by the way, General Flynn, the new national security advisor, met a few weeks ago with the head of the Austrian neo-Nazi Freedom Party. So, but my understanding is that the biggest sellout in terms of the politics of Germany vis-a-vis Russia is Gerhard Schröder, the Social Democrat leader, who has basically been bought off by Putin. Am I being too unkind?
Well, Schröder certainly did not cover himself with glory after he stepped down. Gerhard Schröder, who was the German chancellor in the early 2000s and late 1990s, interestingly enough, he was one of the supporters of the U.S.-led NATO mission in Kosovo in 1999, a mission that was very much opposed by Putin and by Russia at the time. But after he stepped down from office, he joined a large corporation working with Russia to develop a new gas pipeline running from Russia through the North Sea, bypassing Poland. And he has been paid very well. I don't remember the details about that. And yes, I mean, Putin tries to use every instrument that's available to him to exercise and gain influence in the West. And unfortunately, there are people who are willing to cooperate with him. It is difficult, however, while you can buy off individuals and while you can influence politics from the margins, and sometimes that can have a decisive impact, but it is difficult to try to buy an entire political establishment. And so Germany is not for sale, fortunately. Some other countries may be more susceptible to Russian influence, especially to the eastern parts of Europe, because they are poorer countries, and Russia has deeper and perhaps in some ways more complex ties with those societies.
Right, but the part of this that's just so extraordinary is that we're talking about essentially what happened yesterday. Obviously, we've broadened the conversation out a bit, but a truck plowed into Christmas shoppers at the Berlin market right there in this historic spot in Germany in front of the Kaiser Wilhelm Memorial Church, which is, whose spire is still bomb damaged from World War II. They've deliberately left it there as a reminder of how much of Berlin that was destroyed at the end of the war. And the idea that 12 people were just run over and 48 or 49 were injured, some of them very seriously. They captured a Pakistani guy that some bystander had chased down. Turns out that he's probably not the suspect, and the suspects got away. He killed, shot and stabbed a Polish truck driver who apparently owned the truck, or his brother owns the truck. And the truck was hijacked. This guy's got away. We don't know when and if they'll catch him. But that's the situation we're in now. But as you pointed out, it's created a tremendous political crisis, and a growing one for Angela Merkel. But what people don't remember is that the outflow of refugees from the Middle East that ended up in about a million coming into Germany, as we recall, seeing all those very dramatic pictures last year, that outflow happened after Russia intervened in Syria militarily. And it's possible now that with the fall of Aleppo that there could be another huge number of Sunnis escaping the Shiite majority of this murderous leader of a country that he has destroyed, Assad. So you could have, Putin holds the levers, you know, he can, as the former head of NATO said, he can weaponize refugees.
Well, he can try to do that, and to some extent that has already happened. I should emphasize, though, that, I mean, a little bit over a third of the refugees are actually from Syria. The refugees which are arriving in Europe, not only in Germany, though Germany has taken in by far the largest number in absolute terms, are coming from all across the greater Middle East. I mean, they're coming from Algeria, they're coming from Morocco, they're coming from Libya, which we managed to destabilize. They're coming, of course, from Syria. They're also coming further afield from Afghanistan. And so really what we're seeing here is the result of a number of trends coming together, but this sort of enormous arc of crisis stretching from North Africa to Afghanistan and Pakistan, which is generating this huge number of people who are moving towards safety, prosperity, and the dream of a better future. And so part of that is attributable to Russian activities, but I think the Russians can be said to have exacerbated an already bad situation. Also, ironically, and I certainly do not approve of Russian policy in Syria, but ironically, what we may see is we may see a restabilization of Syria. It's the sort of stability of a concentration camp that will result if we have a victory of the Assad regime. But that's quite possible. And if so, then some of those refugee pressures, those pressures which are pushing refugees out from Syria, will decline. The other thing which one also has to understand is that the Europeans have changed their policy considerably since 2015. There has been, in general, a toughening of the borders. There has been a toughening of the rules dealing with refugees. While Europe is continuing to take in refugees who face a well-grounded fear for persecution, we're trying not to send people back into situations where they're going to be killed. But nonetheless, there are people being sent back, for example, to Afghanistan, who are facing real dangers there. And also terribly important, and this is another part of the story if you want to further broaden the conversation, I mean, central to the entire European strategy for dealing with refugees has been working with neighboring countries, countries near the heart of the crisis, around Syria in particular, and above all, working with Turkey in order to make them the front line of defense, the bastions which are preventing even larger numbers of people making their way to Europe. As you may recall, last year, Merkel led the negotiations with the Turkish President Erdogan, offering him aid, important diplomatic concessions, and also increased visa freedom to visit Western Europe, in return for Turkey promising to disrupt the networks, human trafficking networks, which were helping bring refugees into Europe, and for housing and taking care of refugees in Turkey, as opposed to letting them move on to Europe. So there are a number of factors which are now in place, institutions, arrangements, which will help the Europeans get a handle, not solve, but get a handle on the refugee crisis, as long as that agreement, by the way, with Erdogan holds. That's a critical caveat and something we have to watch moving forward.
Sure, and because Erdogan's foreign minister and the Russian foreign minister and defense minister, along with the Iranian foreign minister, made an announcement today in Moscow that they've come to an agreement to end the civil war in Syria. Not that they can end it, but they've certainly come to an agreement about supporting Assad. So I thank you, Thomas Berger, for joining us here today.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you, Ian, as always.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Berger, who's a professor of international relations at Boston University. He specializes in German politics, international relations and comparative government, and political culture. He's the author of War Guilt and World Politics After World War II and Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into why Trump's new national security advisor met recently with the head of Austria's anti-immigration freedom party, which was founded by former Nazis. Strikes now, so here's what's striking me. Tell all you fascists, you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to fight. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us. This one. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now are Daniel Serwer, who's a professor and director of the Conflict Management Program and senior fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Previously, he was the vice president for Centers of Peacebuilding Innovation at the United States Institute of Peace, and from 1994 to 1996 served as U.S. Special Envoy and Coordinator for the Bosnian Federation, mediating between Croats and Muslims and negotiating the first agreement reached at the Dayton Peace Talks. He also blogs at peacefair.net. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Serwer.
My pleasure.
And there's obviously a great deal of concern about the ship of state, at least the helmsman, starting after January the 20th. Apparently Donald Trump is sort of holed up in Trump Tower, watches cable news and gets fired up and tweets in the middle of the night. Doesn't seem to want to do the job, doesn't seem to be interested in the job, and delegated a lot to Mike Pence, who's put together a cabinet. And if you've got a sort of absentee landlord, in effect, as your commander-in-chief, one would expect that at the National Security Council level, you'd have real adult supervision. And as far as I can tell from the people he's chosen, with Mike Pence, Monica Crowley, and K.T. McFarland, they're all sort of ideologues and, you know, conspiracy theorists, just like Trump himself is. So how can you run a national security apparatus for the lone superpower if you don't have reality-based people in charge of your national security?
I don't know how you can do that. I wouldn't try myself. I think especially in the National Security Council people, you've got an advisor and two deputies who could never be confirmed by Congress, by the Senate, and that's their main qualification. They are Fox News commentators, and in the case of Flynn, a really very flaky former general whose merits are difficult to see.
But they don't need to be confirmed. That's the scary part, right? I mean,
that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And that appears to be part of the logic of naming them for these particular positions, that they don't need confirmation. But Flynn has propagated lots of conspiracy theories. He's worked for the current Turkish government in the past. He's the Iranians' favorite general because of his statements implying that Barack Obama is the founder of ISIS. So what you've got here is a fantasy-based National Security Council.
Well, but today's announcement in Moscow that Turkey, Iran, and Russia are going to be in charge of settling the war in Syria, presumably on their terms. Obviously, the war is not going to end soon, but the attitude from the Russian defense minister in making this announcement is pretty much like America's failed and we're going to secure the peace in Syria. The compact between Russia, Turkey, and Iran, if Flynn and Tillerson, the Secretary of State, and Trump himself are all, you know, obviously fairly close to Russia, and on top of that, you got Flynn's ties to Turkey. It's almost as if they're going the United States, at the very top level of our government, are going to be in this kind of compact with the dark side, or what George W. Bush would refer to as the axis of evil.
Well, there's a contradiction here. The administration is the new incoming administration. Is extremely hostile towards Iran. It may be friendly towards Russia and towards an increasingly autocratic Turkey, but it's very hostile towards Iran. So they can't really join that group. And frankly, if that group can bring a permanent ceasefire to Syria, I think Barack Obama would wish them well. I might even wish them well if they can do that. I don't think they can. I think they'll fail. But Trump's attitude towards that particular combination of forces is very unclear to me, because though he may like two of them, he doesn't like the third.
Well, that's the bifurcation in their foreign policy team. You've got Rex Tillerson, the head of Exxon, as the Secretary of State, very close to Putin, wants to make these big oil deals and perhaps even make even broader strategic deals with Russia, in effect, U.S. and Russia against China, and certainly change the situation in the Middle East. There's some real possibilities there. But on the other hand, you've got John Bolton and, for example, the U.S. ambassador to Israel and others that are chosen by the son-in-law and Adelson and all of these very right-wing Likudniks on the U.S. side. So how could you have that schizophrenic government? Could that function? Or is that just like turning over the Middle East to Netanyahu?
Well, all administrations have disagreements internally. There's nothing unusual about that. I think there is something unusual about an administration that's so pointed in many different directions, as this one appears to be, with an overall tone of radical change in American foreign policy. So it becomes exceedingly difficult to understand what direction they're going to move in, because all they've promised is change, and the people they're choosing are promising change in many different directions. Now, Bolton hasn't been named yet, and I have my doubts as to whether he ever will be named because of opposition in the Senate. But the others, Tillerson has been named. He's clearly determined to have a friendlier relationship with Russia. But I don't think he's soft on Iran, and nor is Flynn. So the notion that somehow Trump can make common cause with Iran, Russia, and Turkey doesn't convince me.
So let's talk a little about this meeting that took place several weeks ago between General Michael Flynn, Donald Trump's pick to be the National Security Advisor, and the head of Austria's Anti-Immigrant Freedom Party, which was founded after World War II by former Nazis. What is going on there?
I think what's going on is that Mr. Flynn is looking for allies in wherever he can find them in the world who share the ethno-nationalist right-wing fervor of the incoming Trump administration. Now, look, it's normal government, U.S. government practice to be in touch with opposition parties almost every place where we have embassies. So there's nothing absolutely unusual in that. But this is a strange choice for an early meeting with the National Security Advisor, because this is a Nazi-sympathizing party. And, it just behooves us to be much more reserved than that and to be quieter about it.
So going ahead then, how do we... the terrible thing is that we don't even have an opposition anymore in this country. It doesn't feel like it. The Democratic Party has no leadership. It seems it has no direction. They're licking their wounds. They're like in a daze that the head of the FBI did them in, and then Putin tipped the scales and so forth. And it's just absolutely amazing how, even though they've had the White House for two terms, they've basically lost so much of the House and Senate. So where is the opposition to this incredibly rightward drift in U.S. foreign policy and what appears to be a complete abandonment of U.S. values in terms of human rights and American values?
I think there's quite a bit of opposition. You'll see it in the streets, I think, on January 23rd, when there'll be a major women's demonstration in Washington. I think you see it in the almost universal rejection of Trump in the not only the Democratic foreign policy establishment, but also the Republican foreign policy establishment in Washington. I think you'll see it eventually emerge in the Congress as well, in particular during the confirmation hearings for these various nominees for what I call the anti-cabinet, because except for defense and homeland security, all of the nominees oppose the missions of the departments that they've been appointed to. I think you'll see lots of opposition emerge. You won't have the same kind of unity that you have in the Democratic Party when it has the presidency, and it will be a very difficult role to be in opposition in both houses of Congress as well as to the White House. It's not going to be easy for the Democrats to rebuild. You're right, they're licking their wounds, but they have to turn towards rebuilding. And I think there's actually quite a bit to rebuild on. Trump did not win the popular vote. He won the Electoral College, and he didn't win the Electoral College by all that much. So I don't think we should exaggerate the dimensions of this defeat. It was a bad one because of the loss of all the House, the Senate, and the White House all at the same time. But it wasn't by a gigantic margin.
So is it possible then that there could be the most effective check and balance against Trump and his, particularly the national security team that he has? Could it therefore come from Republican Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham? I mean, they're the only ones that have stood up very resolutely in terms of needing to look into the Russian hacking. And now that the U.S. intelligence community has come to a consensus that not only did Russia hack this last election, they also, the intention was on Putin's part to tip the scales for Donald Trump and to hurt Hillary Clinton, who apparently he hates. So that's now on the record. As you know, the president's ordered an inquiry into this, which will be released before Trump's inauguration. Trump, of course, is trying to deny this and wants this to go away. And his people are the same, and most of the Republicans seem to have sold out in terms of U.S. foreign policy as protecting our national security. I mean, it's pretty hard to believe that you can have an attack on American democracy itself. And as Bob Gates said on Sunday on Meet the Press, you know, the response has been so laid back, it's alarming. I mean, what the hell's going on with these Republicans except for McCain and Lindsey Graham?
I don't think this question of the Russian hacking will go away. I think it will be quite persistent, not only because the Republicans, but because the Democrats will also pursue it. And I think it has real possibility for limiting the damage that Mr. Trump can do, because I think it's quite clear from the hacking that this was intended to damage American democracy, and that it has damaged American democracy because of the lack of unity in responding to the attack. And I think we'll see some patriots rising to the top on this subject, and I think it's going to be really quite difficult for Trump to give away the store to the Russians, as I'm pretty certain he would like to do.
But do you think we'll find out what the ties are between Trump and Putin and the financial ties to Russian oligarchs? Because there has to be an explanation for why Trump has gone out of his way to make excuses for Putin in the face of all of this evidence.
I don't know the answer to that question. I would think that the financial ties, if they exist, that is financing coming from Russia to Trump companies, that should be discoverable. I don't think there's any evidence that Trump has major investments in Russia. In fact, there's some evidence that he was never successful at that, though he tried many times. And it appears that one of his purposes might be to enable such investments in Russia, but nobody has really proven that. I think it's fair to say that you know, the idea of the United States making common cause with Russia is not one that's unique to Mr. Trump. That's something that John Kerry has tried very hard to implement. It's something that in the reset Hillary Clinton tried quite a few years ago. Everybody has failed at that. And I don't have any reason to believe that Mr. Trump is going to be more successful unless he offers the Russians some very juicy advantages. For example, if he were to offer to recognize the Russian annexation of Crimea, that would be something that Putin would certainly appreciate. And he might even go further than that and offer settlements in Ukraine generally that are anathema to the current administration. And that's what people in Congress have to be alert to, is what is Trump willing to give to get friendship with the Russians?
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Daniel Sower.
It's my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Daniel Sower, who is a professor and director of the Conflict Management Program and a senior fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Previously, he was the vice president for Centers of Peacebuilding Innovation at the United States Institute for Peace. And from 1994 to 1996, he served as U.S. Special Envoy and coordinator for the Bosnian Federation, mediating between Croats and Muslims and negotiating the first agreement reached at the Dayton peace talks. He also blogs at peacefair.com. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the announcement today in Moscow by the foreign ministers of Russia, Turkey, and Iran that they are ready to act as guarantors in a peace deal between the Syrian government and the opposition. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Henri Barki, who's the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barki.
Thank you.
And what do you make of the meeting between the foreign ministers of Russia, Iran, and Turkey today in Moscow, where they announced that they would be the guarantors of a peace deal in Syria between the Assad government and the opposition?
Well, this is the final nail in the coffin of the opposition in Aleppo. The Turks essentially are conceding that their allies have lost and they have no choice but to essentially sue for peace with the Russians and the Iranians. But what the Turks are trying to do here is to get a deal with the Russians so that they can turn around and hit the pro-American Kurdish troops who are trying to get Raqqa back from the Islamic State. So in effect, especially after the assassination yesterday of the Russian ambassador in Ankara, you're seeing that there's a major change in the balance of power in the region, in the sense that the Russians and the Iranians are now on top. Assad is not going anywhere, and the opposition is in complete disarray in Syria. The bulk of the moderates either have pulled back or have been defeated. What's left is al-Nusra in Idlib and the Kurds in the western part of the country. So essentially the handwriting is on the wall and the Turks are, you know, basically suing for some kind of a deal. And this is in the context also of deteriorating American-Turkish relations. So the Turks are trying to show the Americans that, look, we have other options, we have other friends, we can make deals. And, interestingly enough, they try to keep the Americans out of this. So this is part of a complicated game that is being played, especially, and it comes at a difficult time for the United States because we're in a period of transition. The Obama administration has very few levers and options that are available, and the incoming Trump administration doesn't have its act together yet, understandably, and it's going to take a very long time for the Trump administration to figure out exactly what he wants to do in that part of the world. It's not clear, and what you're seeing also on the part of the Russians and Iranians who are trying to take advantage of this. And what will be very interesting to see is whether the Turks also try to take advantage of the situation by moving against the Kurds, as I said earlier.
Well, at the press conference in Moscow, the Russian foreign minister and the defense minister made no secret of their crowing at the expense of the Americans. That we're the winners. We're the ones that are going to end this war in Syria. And the Americans don't count.
Well, look, I mean, it's a Pyrrhic victory. I mean, let's not exaggerate the victory that they have won. I mean, look at the state of Aleppo. I mean, it's in ruins. The population is gone. Insofar as there are refugees, and there are refugees in Turkey and in Jordan and in Lebanon and Iraq, sure, but in that sense, those countries are paying a very big price. But what does Syria get out of this? What do the Iranians get out of this? They have a Syrian state that is was on the verge of collapse. Okay, so they've managed to keep it alive, but it is a country that can produce anything, that is in constant need of equipment, material, oil, you name it. And they're going to have to continue to subsidize it. They're going to have to continue to keep it going, and it's not going to be cheap.
Right.
So
it's not going to be stable, neither. It won't be stable, will it? Won't there still be an insurgency? I mean,
will be an insurgency, and they will probably go in to try to deal with the remaining insurgency. One part of the insurgency is in the province of Idlib, and that insurgency tends to be very hardline al-Qaeda and al-Nusra types. And then there's an insurgency near the Israeli border, and then you have the Islamic State, which the Syrian Kurds and the Americans are trying to destroy. Now, if the Turks were to go after the Syrian Kurds and upset that balance, then we are in real trouble, but there's a way in which the Turks and the Syrians and the Russians are far more in front of in danger than we are. I mean, it's still a problem for us.
Right.
So nobody wins out of this. This is a disaster for everybody. The Russians may feel good because they managed to stop what they think the American plot to overthrow Assad and replace him with a more, shall we say, pliable or more pro-Western, anti-Iranian, anti-Russian leader. In that sense, they have succeeded. But at what cost? At what cost for the Iranians?
And again, I'm speaking with Henri Barkey, who's the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Well, so given that it looks as though the very thing that the Saudis were concerned about, this so-called Shia Crescent, has become a reality, with Iran essentially controlling Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon through its proxies, you don't see that as a victory?
Well, look, let's be realistic here. I mean, Syria was always a client state of Iran. Lebanon, because of Hezbollah, has been a client state of Iran. Nothing has changed in this regard, right? So the only issue is what happens to Iraq. And in Iraq, you have obviously the Shia component of Iraq that is pro-Iranian, but it's not like Syria or Lebanon, where they are completely dependent on Iran. So, yes, the Iranians have a conduit, a direct conduit. They can ship arms. And I mean, for the Iranians, the most important asset here is not Assad. It's Hezbollah. They cared about Assad because Hezbollah is their most potent weapon, both against Israel and the West. So they're desperate to keep Hezbollah as a functioning, powerful, potent force. So that's been the whole game in Syria. So, but Iraq has yet to settle down, and Iraq has, for better or for worse, normal politics. And by that I mean it has politicians, it has people who have their own interests. And at the moment, everybody's focused on Mosul and the threat of the Islamic State. But once that's gone, I think the Iraqis will have to put their country together, and they cannot afford to make the mistake they did earlier of, you know, being essentially dismissive of the Sunni interests in Iraq that gave rise to both Al-Qaeda first and then ISIS. So, you know, it remains to be seen what the new Iraq is going to be. It is possible that new Iraq is also going to be a client state of Iran. I'm not necessarily dismissing that probability. That said, I think the jury is out. Mm-hmm. But then again, you know, so the Iranians have won, again, at a huge cost to themselves. I mean, they've lost people. Hezbollah has lost people. It's been, you know, they've had to pour money, and they're going to continue to pour money into Syria to prop up Assad. Mm-hmm.
Let's turn. We've only got a few more minutes left, so I wanted to address a couple of other issues. One is that already the Erdogan's press is alleging American involvement in the assassination of the Russian ambassador. Erdogan blames the assassination on Fethullah Gulen, the exiled cleric living here in the United States. My sense is, Henri Baki, that the assassin represents probably a lot of Turkish opinion who are appalled about what the Russians have done in Aleppo. And Erdogan, is there a split then between Erdogan, his anti-Americanism and cozying up to the Russians, and what the street in Turkey feels about what's happening in Syria?
There is a split between the street and Erdogan on the question of the Russians. That said, Erdogan trumps the street. In other words, Erdogan can carry the street whenever he wants. It is, however, very dangerous, the kind of game he's playing in terms of this anti-Americanism, because today, there was a poll 2 weeks ago that came out that said 79% of the Turkish public now believes that the United States was behind the July 15th coup attempt that ended disastrously. So this kind of anti-Americanism, when Turkey is a member of NATO and Turkey is essentially has been a Western-oriented country, is dangerous in the following sense. The Turks are not going to get out of NATO. The Turks are not going to give up, because that is a security blanket. When they talk to the Russians, knowing that they are a member of NATO gives them some power, some security, if you want, because otherwise the Russians can really dictate things to the Turks. So they're not going to break. But on the other hand, this kind of anti-Americanism can also produce the kind of violence that we saw against the Russians, right? I mean, there are American ambassadors and consul generals, etc., are well protected, but there are a lot of American tourists who go to Turkey. So, you know, you never know what crazy guy will do, like we saw yesterday, and decide to take pot shots at Americans. So they're playing a very, very dangerous game. Now, this is also a game that may end when Trump becomes president, because the big mistake that Obama made with Turkey is that he did not confront the anti-Americanism propagated by Erdogan and his colleagues, and Erdogan ran with it. If Obama had told him to cut it out in a very clear fashion, this would not have happened. I think here Obama has made a mistake. But with respect to Trump, I think Erdogan is going to try to see if Trump first is a friend before he decides whether or not he's going to play the same games. And you'll see a major change in the rhetoric, I think, come January 20th.
But it seems as though Putin has more leverage in this deal than Erdogan, and the killing of the ambassador, the Russian ambassador, wouldn't that give Putin more leverage in whatever...
Absolutely, because remember that the killing of the ambassador is the second big event in Turkish-Russian relations. In November 2015, a Russian bomber, which crossed into Turkish airspace for some 17 seconds, was shot down by the Turks. And at the moment, at the time, both Erdogan and the then Prime Minister Mr. Davutoglu, both very proudly went on television and said, "Yes, we shot down this plane, and if another plane were to show up again in the same conditions, we would shoot it down again." And what happened? The Russians snapped sanctions. Russian tourism was completely stopped. Russians put a stop to Turkish exports to Russia, and this was a huge blow for the Turks. I mean, they lost a huge amount of money, and then so they had to give in. And when they gave in, they decided to blame the Gulen movement for shooting down the airplane. They said, the officers, this has also happened after the July 15th coup, they said the officers who shot down the airplane, right, were Gulenists, and they did it deliberately to undermine Turkish-Russian relations. Nobody in this world believes that story, except for the Turks and some Turks. And I don't think even Erdogan believes that story, because pilots are not going to shoot down in a Russian aircraft knowing that they're going to have to land in Turkey, and if they did it against orders, they will be court-martialed. So this story is complete nonsense, and yet they have been talking about it and trying and basically saying, the Gulenists shot down the plane, we did not do it, therefore Russians, we are actually innocent. And now they're doing exactly the same thing. They're saying, the guy who killed the ambassador is a Gulenist. How do they know he's a Gulenist? I mean, they killed the guy, they don't have any way of questioning him. And in fact, he went through all kinds of security checks and he passed because he was a security guard, I mean, a police officer in an elite security squad. So nobody in the world believes that these are Gulenists, right? So the Turks are making fools of themselves. They don't understand that they look terrible in the eyes of the world, because everybody realizes that they're making up these stories. And the Russians, are laughing all the way to the bank, right? Let them blame the Gulenists, but the Russians use very carefully all these chips that the Turks are giving them, and taking them to the bank in exchange for concessions. And yes, you're absolutely right. The Turkish position against Russia has been very much weakened, which is why the Turks will continue to hold on to NATO, because that's the only security blanket against a very aggressive Russian bear.
Well, Henri Barkey, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Henri Barkey, who's the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.